Hey, this is Dr. Drew, and I just want to thank you for joining the Dr. Drew podcast and supporting the Corolla Pirate Ship here at the Corolla Network. And please, just a reminder, tell a friend about these podcasts. That is how this thing grows organically, and that is how we want this to grow. We want it to be a community of people that connect, and we talk about interesting things. And by the way, feel free to give us feedback and stuff, particularly for my show, that you'd like to hear. We'll be happy to set it up on the program. And again, tell a friend and keep this pirate ship afloat.
This is Corolla Digital.
Hey, everybody. Welcome to Dr. Drew Podcast. Let's get right on out to a call. This is Kyle from Atlanta. Kyle, what's going on?
Dr. Drew, how you doing?
Good. What's up?
Well, thank you very much, you know, for what you're doing. And simply, I am a single father of a 2 years old, and I've been I went through the same thing that my son is going through. Is I was born, my mom died like when I was 2 years old, but in my case, that we divorced, and anyways, I had some women issue when I was young, and
Kyle, you're speaking in sweeping generalities. What exactly are you talking about?
I'm talking about, I am about to get married to a woman I was supposed to get married to a woman, but it didn't work out. And I've been going through this a lot of times within the last 2 years. Being girlfriend, boyfriend, the last one, I wasn't able to, it didn't work out because I don't trust women, because when I was young, my father, he was single dad.
Okay, so hang on. So you were abandoned by your mom?
My mom passed away when I was 2 years old.
Okay, Kyle, it's time to deal with that. And if you are so fearful of abandonment, so fearful of intimacy for fear of abandonment, that you literally sabotage these relationships or don't even enter into them, you have got to go to therapy. I mean, there's no fooling. You're 32 years old. It's time, man. You believe me, you're not a young baby anymore. You're not a child. You're not an adolescent. You're an adult. You can manage these feelings. No problem. They'll feel shattering, but they are not. You're an adult. But they are not going to get processed by themselves. You literally have got to go into a therapeutic environment. Ideally, I bet cognitive behavioral therapy would work here too, but I like the idea of emotionally focused therapy, so somebody can drill in with you in a what we call an intersubjective context. I'm going to be posting a podcast soon with Dr. Alan Shore, who really is the world's expert on the neurobiology of intersubjectivity, how our brains relate to each other, one brain to another. And literally in the context of being close to another person, you can tolerate feelings, and therapists are specifically trained to be able to help you do this. You can tolerate feelings that you cannot tolerate by yourself. You've got to, I know you think you can and you want to think your way through it. You can't. You just can't. Your history tells us that. You've tried, and now here you are about to get married. You're either going to recreate the past, which is what we always do as humans, by hooking yourself up with a woman that's going to abandon you, which is the worst situation of all, or you're going to sabotage this relationship as a way of controlling it to prevent the abandonment. Either way, you're in trouble. Get that therapy. Please go do that. Quick reminder, our friends at Lumosity.com want you. The Corolla Pirate Ship needs you. To head on over to Lumosity.com, click on the Start Training button, and you start training for free. It's a way of training your brain. We all train our bodies. We all worry about that stuff, but are enough of us thinking about our brains? Many of you may have missed your opportunity in high school to train your brain. Here's a way to reach back. These guys base these games on the science of neuroplasticity. It's fun. It's interesting, and you will actually track and see your progress on the feedback they give you. They give you graph feedback of how you are improving with these brain memory and a lot of it's visual processing and memory and focus and attention. And it's actually a little bit disturbing sometimes to see where you fall on the spectrum. But the good news is if you do these games on a regular basis, you can improve. And if you improve, you will do better in your function at work, obviously. I know I do these games repetitively. Corolla says he does them. So you guys join us at Lumosity.com. Click on the Start Training button, and you'll be training for free. Tell them you heard it from me, Dr. Drew. And speaking of brain chemistry, we are now welcoming to the program Dr. Stephen Porges, who is an expert. This is another layer. This is not Alan Shore, who you hear from on a future podcast. this Stephen Porges is, again, one of my heroes, and he has really developed the science of the parasympathetic nervous system and the vagus nerve and how that relates to emotional processing. You will see what I mean. It sounds like a mouthful, but he will make it understandable for you, I promise. Enjoy the show. Welcome to the Dr. Drew Podcast. Today, I am very excited. I am privileged to welcome to the program a gentleman who has Dr. Porges, are you there?
I'm here, yes.
I want to gush about you for a second because I am a giant fan of your work and the observations that you've brought to light. I thought it was time we took your material to the public, which I know is going to be a little bit of a task because it's very physiological and very technical, but this is the future of our...
We're offline now,
No,
right?
No, we're on. We're on the
we're
air.
On.
We're
oh,
on.
Okay.
We are officially
okay.
on. I know it sounds okay. like I'm not talking live, but I am.
Okay, then go ahead and gush. Go right ahead.
Yes. Dr. Porges developed something called the polyvagal theory. And it is that may not be a term that is immediately apparent what it means to everybody, but he basically has shown how a part of our central of our nervous system that has been ignored for a long time, or at least marginalized, may be at the core of understanding how I don't know how to describe this, how our emotional landscapes work. I came to your work, Dr. Porges, through Alan Shore. I'm a humble disciple of his work, and his work informed everything I do. And he is, by the way, Dr. Shore will be on in a couple of episodes to talk to you about his work. But he has been able to show, you know, how the emotional landscape is built, how the self is built, and how this is we've missed the fact that this is a bodily based experience. And that the autonomic nervous system, the sort of brakes and accelerator of our system, has been marginalized in our understanding of this thing we call emotions and feelings. Is that a good way to sort of bring it to life?
It's a good start, okay. But I was actually going, if you don't mind me bouncing in.
Please, bring it.
Okay. I finally realized that you were trained as an internist.
Yes, I'm trained as an internist.
And what I would say is, to start this, I would say that what I do is really the interface between internal medicine and psychiatry.
Yes.
So you should find yourself feeling very much at home with the linkage of the autonomic nervous system to behavioral mental health disorders.
Well, and it maybe that's why you ended up in addiction medicine too, because that's a similar crossroad. You know, it's very much, you know, medical. There's a lot of medical stuff going on. There's neurobiology that's completely out of whack. There's interpersonal, there's dynamic issues, there's psychiatric issues, but ultimately it is about the body and the body's relation to the brain. And that is something that I think has been – and when people talk, for instance, you know, I'm getting off topic completely right away here, but whenever I hear people talking about, you know, computers or artificial intelligence, I immediately think, no, wait a minute, humans have this other thing that they're embedded in that informs so much of what they're experiencing. Maybe it's all of what they're experiencing, but it also informs what they're thinking, how they remember things, and how they process information. It's why there's things like intuition and why we have insights. Those are actually our bodies creating those sorts of moments, I suspect.
Well, we are biological. I mean, that's what we are. And whatever we do, whether it's art or music or social interactions, is really based on our biology. And this tends to be, you know, marginalized, this importance. And as you already realize, that we live in a world that is very, I'll use the term cognitive-centric or cortical biased.
Yes.
It's being the same thing, that this little part of the brain that deals with our awareness and our alertness and our consciousness, we believe is the major role of our brain. And it's not really to help our body run. And the way our body is functioning also feeds back and provides portals of accessibility to different mental competencies.
Well, let's try to talk about the vagus nerve and what you observe. Talk about the polyvagal theory. I gave a lecture at the University of Southern California. Not, I know where you are. Dr. Porges is a professor of psychiatry at the University of North Carolina. By the way, you can find more information at StephenPorges, P-O-R-G-E-S.com. And the book, which will be on our website, is The Polyvagal Theory. I gave a lecture at not University of Southern Carolina near you, University of Southern California, which is our USC. And I tried to tiptoe into your material. It was interesting because I do think I do use it so much in terms of helping people understand emotional regulation and intersubjective experiences. And they were pretty receptive. I even wrote an exam question about it, which is about basically, you know, what is the polyvagal theory? Basically, was my in a national in a format that we're all accustomed to. But talk about what you observe, how you got into this.
Well, I got it. I'll talk about the history of getting into it in a moment. But first, the theory is extraordinarily neurophysiologically based, but it's also intuitive. So now you have this balance between really deep science and the history of neuroanatomy and neurophysiology and the study of evolution on one side, and the other side, the intuition of this is how we feel, this is how we act. And when you put those layers together, suddenly you demystify a lot of the unusual experiences people have had, especially those who have been traumatized or have severe mental health issues. How I got into this is really backwards. I think we all get into things that interest us about feelings and trying to understand our body, but we often go into a profession. So I started off in psychology, and I was interested in physiological markers or parallels of psychological processes, with kind of a dream that you could put electrodes on people and you could understand a lot about them without talking to them. Okay, so you could understand a lot about their physiological states. And as I started to do my work, and this is actually now several decades ago, I start to ask more serious questions, not simply were there correlates or relationships between autonomic activity and cognitive processes or emotional states, but what were the pathways? What were the neurophysiological pathways? I was actually trying to figure out how the system worked. And I had been studying heart rate patterns, and this may sound extremely boring to many of the listeners, but I was interested in how the nervous system was reflecting information in the patterning of a heartbeat. And this becomes real when we start to understand that our heart is really governed in part by a large nerve that comes out of the brainstem called the vagus. So the vagus functions literally as a brake, and people who are resilient and people who can engage others, have good self-control, tend to have good control vagal influences on the heart. So when they stand up and the heart rate accelerates, they can calm down rapidly with this vagal influence. And I got into this, the whole polyvagal theory started in the 1990s because I thought I had really made my major contributions. I had developed methodologies to measure vagal activity at the heart, and I was really having fun measuring this activity in various clinical disorders, from preterm babies, babies vulnerable for SIDS, to hyperactive kids, to a whole variety of different populations. And I published a paper in a journal called Pediatrics, and I got a letter back from a neonatologist, and the letter was really quite interesting. It was a letter that said, "I really enjoyed your paper," but it had the following phrase, "However." And those of us who are in the academic world, we always are very, very, you know, this is where the however gets you.
Yeah, it's going to be a punch that follows.
Right. So the point was, however, when I was in medical school, I learned that the vagus could kill you. And I was, in my paper, trying to talk about the vagus as protective of preterm and full-term babies, and this was a good indicator of the developmental trajectory. And so I realized, well, his final statement was, perhaps too much of a good thing is bad. And whenever someone says that, that simplistic explanation really deserves to be
unpacking.
Questioned.
Unpacking.
Yeah. Attack, yeah. Unpack it, look at it, and see what it really means, because obviously you're looking at two different worlds. And in medical school, he's right. What people are taught is that the bradycardias or the apneas of preterm babies, they're vagally mediated and they can kill you.
Babies, like, not adults so much, but babies.
Not, well, it potentially can happen in adults also, but this literally got expunged out of a lot of the literature. So just like a turtle or a reptile immobilizes under threat, and their heart rates go very, very slow, and they stop breathing because they have to go into water and reduce metabolic activity. Preterm babies do this, and except it's almost is potentially lethal. They go into bradycardia as the heart rates get very slow, and they stop breathing.
And let me hook this up right away and early in this story so people can relate to it. It's also oftentimes what we do in extreme circumstances of terror. We go from hyperstimulation and fight or flight to hyperinhibition, where the body is going into a metabolically conservative state to anticipate, like if you're standing in front of a lion, if that lion hits you, you're ready for it. You can no longer run away, but you're prepared. And it also, at the same time, this is the connection that people will make, is at the same time as that vagus nerve is putting out a bunch of stuff into the body, the brain is getting flooded with cortisol and opioid blocking types of chemicals.
Right. So actually, it's raising pain thresholds, and people are dissociating and going someplace else. Cool. And what you'll find as the story unfolds is that this fits the description, as you're saying, of many people who have had been abused, been suffer from PTSD, and there was no explanation about their symptoms because people thought it was all, quote, a stress response, and stress people talk about as increased sympathetic activity and not vagal.
I don't want to lose people, so I'm going to jump in with stuff that sort of hooks it back to, you know, everyday experience. You know, I think we all know, let's say when you fall in love, you feel a warm feeling in your chest, or people point to their chest. The heart is the source of all kinds of feelings, bodily-based feelings. We all know what we're talking about when we talk about that. Yet when you talk about the brain, how does the brain get you to feel things in your heart? Well, if I remember, part of your polyvagal theory is that something like 80% of the vagus is going the other direction, right?
Right.
So it's actually a feeling instrument as well.
It's a feeling instrument, but it may not have the specificity. So when we get these feelings, we may have difficulty labeling it.
It's a feeling in our chest.
Yeah. So we have, you know, we know we have a change, and we may not have a vocabulary or haven't developed a vocabulary to describe those feelings. You're right on target in the sense that this is a very primitive system. It's a defensive system. But this was not the vagal system that I was studying. It was a protective vagal system.
Well, here's what it was. You were studying the autonomic nervous system. Here's what happened in medical school. You studied the sympathetic and the parasympathetic system, and you study the pharmacology of blocking the various various chemicals that come out of that system or the synaptic pathways in that system. And you go, oh, this one speeds things up, you block it, things slow down. Mm-hmm. This one slows things down, you block it, things speed up. That's the extent. Trust me, the extent of the autonomic nervous system training we had.
Well, it becomes interesting when you look at the history. I want to just put one more point in, and that the type of vagal activity that this gentleman was describing was, in a sense, a potentially lethal response, but what I was studying was a protective response.
So now we're back to the neonatologist or pediatrician, whatever, who sent you
that
letter.
Right, but that created what I call the vagal paradox, and I had to figure this one out. And the answer really came out of studying the evolution of the autonomic nervous system in invertebrates. And what happened is that literally we don't have a simple paired antagonistic system just like you described. We have a sympathetic and a parasympathetic. We do have that, but they're not always at battle. We really have hierarchical systems that inhibit other systems. So in a sense, we have a very ancient vagal shutdown response. We have a sympathetic mobilization fight-flight, which inhibits the shutdown. And then we have this new mammalian vagus, which is linked to the muscles of the face and head. So when people are smiling, when there's good prosody in voice, and when their upper part of the face is alive, that's inhibitory of the sympathetics. So you can see, you know, how the nervous system of social behavior and social interaction is the same as the nervous system that supports health.
Make that connection for people again, because you packed a lot into that. So the primitive system, which is an unmyelinated system?
It's an unmyelinated system, but don't think of it merely as a system that creates That's a lethal system.
No. But it's the system that we share with possums and reptiles.
Oh, we share with reptiles. Yeah. We share with bony fish.
Right, it's the escape when there is no other escape.
It's very simple. It reduces metabolic demands on our body.
But when it does so, it also activates dissociation, which is a very problematic psychological, neurobiological thing. We can talk about that later. But that's the thing. That's the system of last resort. That's when there's no escape.
Right. And those of us, I should say many people, are fortunate that the system is triggered so they don't suffer pain in either dying or being abused. Because they just disappear.
The problem is when this becomes the predominant means of reacting to stress or unpleasant feelings, now you have a big problem.
Absolutely. We evolve not to use this system for defense. We evolve to use the system to support our homeostatic, our health and growth. And so this old unmyelinated vagus was there, and it's very important for our health, for our digestion. But when the system is being used as a defense system, we're in really deep trouble.
And that's largely goes, in addition to being able to do shutdown, it goes also below the diaphragm in terms of regulating.
Below the diaphragm. Yeah. And, of course, when you mention this and start asking what are the internal medicine symptoms of people who have problems, it's always going to be gut problems.
Yeah. They have irritable bowel. They have abdominal pain. They have all kinds of stuff.
And there's one other thing that's linked to this as well. The afferent branch of that vagus coming from the subdiaphragmatic area actually helps regulate nociceptive pain.
I'm going to translate that for you. So the information coming back from the gut through this old vagus changes pain perception.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. So people who have problems with gut, who often have problems even with blood pressure regulation, also often have fibromyalgia.
And of course, people that are traumatized often have all kinds of pain syndromes. Yeah. Then there's the flight or fight response, which is the next layer, which is the predominantly sympathetic system, yes?
Right. And we have to think of everything not as good or bad, but as being adaptive. And once we take that moral veneer off, then we can be helpful. So a lot of people are basically highly mobilized. They're literally in panic a good portion of the time. Many of those people have histories of being immobilized.
Right. And what Dr. Porges is talking about, sexual abuse, physical abuse, interpersonal terror, interpersonal stuff, not just seeing seeing an explosion or a war or something, but it's particularly something of interpersonal terror, wouldn't you say?
Yeah, but it's also, it interacts even with basically clinical medicine. Trauma by diagnosis.
Oh, I know. Listen, I was shocked one day when I was in California, we have to go to these pain conferences to keep up our license, and I went to one, and the director of the pain medicine program gets up and says, you know, funny thing about these pain patients, somewhere 96% of them are sexually or physically abused. Anyway, let's go on to talk to you how we're going to prescribe those opiates for those patients.
So what I've really, as the story starts coming out in terms of this hierarchical system, the symptoms that are clustered around different levels of the polyvagal system, meaning this shutdown, old, unmyelinated, primitive vagus versus a sympathetic nervous system that turns off the subdiaphragmatic vagus, meaning you get constipated, you're tightly wrapped, you're anxious person who's constipated, but the face is now flat, but versus the person whose face is animated and who has lots of vagal activity to the heart, they're basically a much more integrated individual.
Okay, so now we're moved up to the mammalian, what you call the myelinated, mammalian or myelinated system, which is something that evolves in relation to the branchial pouches, which is where our face and all of our – how do you help people understand this? Everything you see above the neck sort of evolves in the same area.
Type of muscles, they're called striated muscles of the face and head, the control comes from the same area that regulates this newer vagus.
Okay, so the facial nerve material, which regulates the face, is related to the source of this new vagus.
Yeah. Now, what this means is we wear our heart on our face.
And that source is something called the nucleus ambiguous, if I remember right.
Yeah. And, of course, how do we wear our feelings and our heart on our face? We, in terms of how our facial muscles work, but also in terms of the prosodic or the intonation of her voice.
And you said something very interesting, too. There's even a relationship between the muscles that adjust the ossicles in our ear and the vagus.
But you've done your homework.
Yes. Oh, I love your material. Are you sure I read your stuff like scripture? I'm telling you.
Wow. Wow. I'm more than flattered. But we'll discuss that offline. But basically, the middle ear, one of the defining features of mammals that most people don't realize is detached middle ear bones. And that enabled mammals during the transition from reptiles to mammals, enabled the mammal to survive by literally having a niche to communicate vocally that the reptiles couldn't hear because their middle ear bones didn't detach.
And then we could literally adjust our attunement to those prosodic changes.
Only if we're in safe environments. Because if we're not in safe environments, we want to hear those big reptiles.
Now, you mentioned that the animated face is an important piece of the vagal function. You must be familiar with Peter Fonagy and his stuff.
A little bit. He
puts a lot on the back and forth facial expression and what that is communicating to a child. And I think I overlaid your theory on his and said, and then thereby activating this vagal function.
Yeah, if it's reciprocal and it becomes a neural exercise, and this is really the word I like using now, that talk therapy or social interactions or just being with another human being, talking, listening, engaging, smiling, these are neural exercises of this face-heart connection.
Isn't that interesting, face-heart connection? That's a fascinating way to say it, because again, when you say face-heart, immediately everyone intuitively knows when you bring your heart into an experience that it's some, again, bodily-based, emotional, feeling-based experience. And what he says is he looks at mothers and infants and he says, you know, the infant is awash in feeling states. They can't – doesn't have language yet necessarily. You can't identify the feelings, can't regulate the feelings. And the first thing the child is an object of scrutiny by the mom. And the mom tries to attune to the child's biological state – and then read it, like what's the content of the child's mind. And then he says when as soon as she knows, it's something that was Winnicott or somebody said, which is that mom looks like what she sees. In other words, what she perceives to be going on in the child's mind, it immediately becomes reflected on her face. Mm-hmm. Not that she is reflecting to the child her constitutional state. The mom doesn't catch the feelings of the child, but she's reflecting an appreciation of the child's primary emotional state. And then that exchange becomes a means for developing emotional regulation.
I totally agree, but there are a couple important points here. If you recall back about 20 or 30 years ago, you're not that old, but earlier in your medical career.
That was 30 years ago. I'm that old.
There were preterm babies were abandoned. And the reason for that was the parents felt that the child didn't love them.
Oh wow!
Or one of the aspects. And when I ask my medical students and graduate students, what do parents of autistic children, parents of severely hyperactive kids, and parents of preterm children often say? They say, "I love my child, but my child doesn't love me." And this goes back to this paradigm you're describing. Because in all those populations, those clinical populations, the face is not working.
Is it also, though, which is first, the chicken or the egg, that they don't appreciate what the content of others' minds and don't reflect it, or they can't attach that vagal mechanism?
It's the attachment, because the children have feelings, and the system is just poorly organized, and the cues that the parent is picking up may not be truly representative of the child's state.
Have we now sort of walked through the polyvagal theory, right? Pretty much?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
How does the polyvagal theory relate to attachment? Can you make that understandable to people?
What I like to say is you don't just have attachment, you have a preamble to being attached. And whether we're talking about with infants or we're talking about peer-peer relationships, you have to be providing signals to the other in a reciprocal way that signals safety.
Okay.
and then you get proximity.
Okay. Once you're talking. It's funny. You know, we're talking about some. Again, I'm trying to make it relatable for people. We're talking about very specific biological, organismic sorts of experiences, but these are the substrate for intimacy. This is how we build closeness with other humans. And by the way, in closeness, we build the capacity for emotional regulation. We find meaning. We find love. We find self. And all of this stuff you're talking about is the requisite for those nice things to happen. Would you agree?
I totally agree, but I also say it supports general health because we have an overlapping circuit with the social behavior we're describing with the neural mechanisms that promote health.
Here's what I want to do. I'm going to take a quick break, and we'll be right back with more of Dr. Stephen W. Porges, isn't it?
Yeah, but you can call me Steve.
Is there a Stephen A. Porges, too?
Who knows? Who knows?
Because I saw the W on everything. I thought, and then the A sounds funny. Dr. Porges, we sort of walked through the polyvagal theory. You have a new book, by the way, coming out called Clinical Applications of Polyvagal Theory. When is that coming out? I can't wait to see that.
Well, it's actually, you should read the second part of the title, which is the transformative power of feeling safe.
You just mentioned feeling safe is what you think this builds.
Yes.
Yeah.
Everything about in my work now is about the triggers to our nervous system that enable us to feel safe, and that when we feel safe, what we get from that in terms of the accessibility of different cognitive functions, different emotional functions, and health, and everything. So not being scared is not the same thing as feeling safe.
Right.
And in part, the medical community has kind of missed this because they're very driven by pharmaceutical treatments, and drugs can, in a sense, dampen certain systems, but they don't necessarily potentiate the systems that we need to be more engaging.
I'll tell you, interpersonal therapies, when people are dealing, particularly emotionally based interpersonal therapies, you know, marriage and family therapy, that kind of thing, The number one thing I always hear people saying is, I don't feel safe. They say it many different ways, but what they're really saying is, I don't feel safe in this relationship. You don't make me feel safe.
Yeah, and I think this is the basis for all mammalian relationships. Mammals have to sleep, they have to be in environments, they have to eat a lot, they have to defecate, they have to do a lot of behaviors that require immobilization and loss of hypervigilance.
Interesting.
So they have to feel safe. And if you think of that in terms of the clinical disorders that people have in terms of ingestive and digestive processes, it's merely representing that their nervous system isn't safe. And you don't make a person safe by telling them to be safe. Their body is doing the decoding.
Right. And now you wanted to mention something about language versus speech.
Yeah. So, again, we live in this very strange time where everything is syntactically driven, word-driven. So people use Twitter, they use email, and they don't convey the prosodic, the intonation of voice. But we evolved. Mammals evolved, not with language, but with vocalizations. And the vocalizations were to convey the physiological state of the other so that we knew we were safe to come together. So all mammals will vocalize, and the vocalizations are really conveying their physiological state. And what I'm going to, since you were trained, I'm going to tease you, but you were trained in neuroanatomy for that course you took. Remember that one?
Oh, well, I remember that one. Yes, I do.
Okay. So there's a nerve called the recurrent laryngeal nerve. It's actually a branch of the vagus.
Yes, it's the one we worry about when we're doing thyroidectomies.
Yeah. Well, it also controls a degree of prosody, and so it parallels the vagal influence to the heart is coming through in prosodic features.
Hmm.
So not only do we wear our heart on our face, we're literally projected in the intonation of our voice.
So, and let's think of another way of communicating that. Is it so our feelings get communicated through our voice?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And actually Darwin acknowledged this in his book on emotions in men and animals. In a sense, high-pitched, narrow... Okay, so if you talk to someone and their voice is a high pitch and it doesn't really have, it's like a shrill voice, what do you know about that person?
They're anxious or they're uptight.
Right,
yeah.
And what about their muscle tone when you look at
high,
them?
High tone, I think.
Right.
Yeah.
And what if they're using a very low voice and they're barking and yelling? It's kind of like a rage response.
Yes,
right?
And rage can go both ways.
Yeah, well, rage can actually go low,
yeah,
too. Yeah.
Yeah.
And so what social communication is in between those boundaries, and our nervous system picks up that information.
Singing must be on the spectrum too. It'd be interesting to check the vagal tone of comfortable singers.
It's I looked at your webpage, so I forgot. Absolutely. And you know, what do mothers do to their babies to make them feel calm before they understand language even?
They sing to them, yeah. They sing to them.
And they don't sing in complex songs. It's very simple lullabies within a certain frequency band. And if we think about those frequencies, this is exactly what the classical composers use to introduce their melodies.
Oh, interesting. So as I add up the score here, it's that we are very focused on communicating with language, yet we've lost track of the rich communication through our facial expression and our vocal intonation.
And where are we going in our society?
More towards the, you know, that's why you can't have a real relationship in an internet, you know, in a chat room.
Okay, and where are we going with our educational system?
Oh, listen, I gave that same lecture I gave to the medical school the other day.
Yeah.
They put them all in a smaller classroom because the mayor had the bigger classroom. And he said, yeah, they'll fit in there. There's only about 80 of them. I said, isn't the class 190 kids? Yeah. The other 110 are watching it on a podcast.
Yeah, it's just amazing because we're so cognitive-centric. But if we had more social interactions, more play, more music, more drama, all these things that require reciprocal interactions, we'd be building through neural exercises. That's what those interactions are, more resilient kids who would then have greater access to their cognitive structures.
This is a big deal. And it's been completely ignored. I've been talking about this. I try to talk about this a lot when I'm out in the world, and it just doesn't, you know, because people are so traumatized, I think they're fearful of even hearing this message.
Well, another way of saying is we're being, the people who have difficulty in face-to-face social interaction are creating the agenda for other people's social interaction.
They are, but in the meantime, we're losing the richness and meaning that humans have relied upon throughout human history. I mean, read any great novel or drama or whatever it is, or listen to a great symphony, whatever it is, it's all there.
Yeah, yes.
Anyway, I get a little disheartened by that. I wanted to ask you something else about the... the vocal part. I lost it.
You want middle ears?
Well, are people responding to your theories? Are physicians picking it up and going with it?
It's been an interesting journey because I come out of very traditional academics, and I'm one of the few people who is still literally a laboratory scientist doing research who's talking to all these other groups, clinical groups all around the world. And it's been very interesting to watch this at one side and then to watch the medical community on the other. So within the past month, I talked at UC San Diego Neuroscience in their medical school, and then I talked at Dartmouth. But in general, I talk much more to, like, family. So I talked to the Erickson Foundation Couples Group in Manhattan Beach a couple weeks ago. So the clinicians are very excited. The academic physicians are becoming excited because there's strong science behind it. The problem within psychiatry, from my perspective, is psychiatry is so drug-oriented in terms of treatment that they lost the interaction with the patient.
Completely. Oh, it's not valued at all. But the whole medical system is lost that. Thankfully, there are ancillary disciplines showing up that are picking this piece up, though, I think.
Well, and the fact is that people are seeking those because they like the social interaction. So the metaphor that I kind of use is that there are, master clinicians regardless of their training.
Right.
But the master clinicians understand all these principles intuitively.
Right. And the rest of us are having it sort of expunged from our practice.
Yes.
It's true. And it really, my thing is that this is so, I know what I want to ask you. I remember now. Does your theory in any way inform – I've always wondered why humans like watching other sick humans act out. Why we – if you look at any great tragedy or great opera or now reality TV shows, you're really looking at sick people acting sick. Does this theory in any way help us understand why people do that, why we look toward that?
Well, I would think in terms of opera, you know, I would go with the you're being led by the music, and the music is...
But it's dramatic music about horrible things, tragedies,
yeah,
and people misbehaving and drawing death and violence.
But it's pulling you in with the prosodic orchestra.
Oh, I get that. I get that. I just wondered why it couldn't be about people behaving nicely and being boring. What is it that makes it interesting to us? And does this theory somehow inform that?
I get, you know, this is a guess.
Okay, I'm ready. It's good. I won't tell your academic colleagues you've been guessing.
You know, this is a guess, but this is actually this guess I think will inform us over time about the effects of trauma. I think certain things occur under a set of one trial learning rules, and that people have forgotten about single trial learning. That was like taste aversion, people who used to get chemotherapy, if they ate something, they could never eat that again.
Yes.
Okay?
Yes.
So single trial exposure, it's not a repeated association, it's something different. And trauma carries a lot of those things. But neurophysiologically, all that single trial learning from that old literature is autonomic.
Yes.
Okay, so what we're doing with listening to the sad music is we're triggering an autonomic system.
Yes.
And hopefully triggering empathy. But I think you were asking something different than empathy. You were actually asking, like with reality TV shows, tend not to elicit empathy.
Right. Why? Well, it's Schadenfreude a little bit. But why?
Yeah.
Why? See, I understand it intuitively that it's more exciting, more arousing, and as such sort of gets our attentional mechanisms going. But why sick people?
Well, I think there are two different things going on. The music is not arousing in the sense that you're talking about. It's pulling people in with pathos.
That makes – the music part makes perfect sense to me.
Let's move that to the side,
yeah,
and talk about reality TV.
Okay.
And I think that's more like roller coaster riding.
Okay.
I think it's coming close to someone's tragedy and then being able to turn it off.
It's like spinning in the chair. It's just self-stimulating.
Yeah. It's a controlled exposure.
Yeah.
Because you can always walk away.
Yeah.
But the music, even in the opera, you can't walk away. You're not allowed to. There's social constraints once you sit down in that music hall.
Well, not only the social, there's musical constraints. You don't get let go until you're back at tonic in a very some sort of dramatic way, back at the tonic key.
Yeah.
Well, Dr. Porges, I want to thank you so much for joining me. It's really been a privilege and a pleasure, and you're everything I expect you to be, and helping me sort of expose the average person to some of these thinking. I think we laid it out in a way that people can access it, and I hope they can contextualize it, because, you know, as clinicians and as a physician, the context of this for me was awakening. It was just immediately obvious how it all fit in with things I was seeing and experience, you know, particularly with addicted and traumatized populations. And then it informed how I approach patients with the prosodic voice and the facial expressions. The other piece that the face does that you may appreciate as a psychologist is it sets a boundary.
Yeah.
It's a signal without a contagion. And it's built into us, and a lot of people don't appreciate that they have these nonverbal ways of communicating that are received on a different level and are done in such a way that there's boundary between the self and the other. The website is stephenporges.com. This Stephen is with a PH. It's PORGES. The book is The Polyvagal Theory. I didn't read you the second subtitle because I was afraid we were going to scare people off.
Not
but
enough
it's
time.
Neurophysiological Foundations of Emotions, Attachment, Communication, and Self-Regulation. And the new book we'll be looking forward to is Clinical Applications of the Polyvagal Theory. I will get – please, you guys, got to put the Polyvagal Theory up on our website,
it's
which you will.
It's on the site.
Good. And it's – if I read it right, it's really a series of essays, is it not? It's papers you've compiled and sort of integrated, yes?
Right, first book. But the second book is – going to be is being written for normal people. It's going to be more conversational and more translational.
Beautiful. I can't. Would you mind coming back again when that comes out? And we'll pump it.
I certainly would love to. Thank
Beautiful.
You.
I appreciate you being here. Thank you, Dr. Porges. We are going to go to break, and then we'll be back with your phone calls right after this.
Hi, I'm Larry Miller, but in a way, aren't we all? And this week on This Week with Larry Miller, we talk about Rosebud, Citizen Kane, and being in a movie in a veterinary clinic where you just ate your dinner off the same table that was a dog's butt. I've done all of those. We'll see you here.
Welcome back to the Doc Drew Podcast. A big thank you to Dr. Stephen Porges, again, one of my heroes. And if you really maybe listen to that a couple times, take in exactly what he's talking about, that is groundbreaking material and really the foundation of how our bodily-based experiences are translated into emotional and feeling experiences. Lots of research on that coming out all the time. I want to go on out to the phones. And by the way, before I do, reminder, podcast, support the podcast. Click through at Amazon.com. Check out the iTunes, Groovy Tunes on the website.
The Swingin' Sounds.
Swingin' Sounds, sorry.
Podcast. And, but they are Groovy Tunes.
And so do support right. The people that support the pirate ship that allow us to keep doing what we're doing here by going ahead and actually using the services that we advertise on the show. This now, we're going out to calls, is Christine. Christine.
Hi.
Hey, what's going on there?
I'm calling because I have actually a lot of things, but and first thing I was calling about was depression, because I've had trouble with it off and on my whole life, well, since I was like 15, mm-hmm. and I'm 46, and I was on the drugs for a long time, like from my early 30s until not long ago, like December.
Medication or drugs?
Medication.
You're not a drug user, you're just taking medication.
No, I'm not a drug user. No, I don't even drink. I'm really boring.
Okay.
But, I went off antidepressants in December. And my psychiatrist wasn't really thrilled, but I wasn't really that thrilled with her anyway. So I just decided that I could try to handle it on my own because I really wanted to. And I have two little kids adopted from foster care. That's why I want to talk about neglect.
But, wow. Oof.
And I have a loving husband who just lost his job again. He's been in and out of work for 6 years, and the stress has been really kind of unreal. But that I was doing really well, or pretty well. I can say, I mean, I'm not 100%, but I think I'm doing pretty well. And then he lost his job about a month ago, and I've really been struggling. But I really want to try and stay off the drugs, and I've been trying really hard to. I've done a lot of research about foods and trying to eat really healthy, try to get, you know, just fruits and vegetables and kind of a paleo style of eating. And I've been finding that I felt a lot better when I really do it. It's hard to stick to it. But that seemed to help a lot. Getting a little more exercise helps. And I just wanted to ask about what you think about being off the antidepressants long term when the doctors are like, oh, you're a lifer. You're going to be on them for the rest of your life. And I thought, well, I don't necessarily buy that argument. And I also, I don't know, maybe I'm a conspiracy theorist, but when I hear you're going to go on these drugs and you're going to be on them for the rest of your life. And I worry about the way that our country runs with the pharmaceutical industry. And part of it's because I work near and around it a little bit. And I just see the way it works.
All right. So listen, but the problem is that you're also implicating people in helping professions who are deeply invested in people getting better. And in most cases, what we try to do is get people off medicines, for sure. Problem is about 50% of people that get off medicines end up back on them again. And that's just simply a statistical fact. In every study that's ever been done, the best outcomes are talk therapy and medication. So the idea is medicines carefully applied and used as short a term as possible, and then long-term psychotherapeutic interventions are really the key thing that, fortunately, nobody can afford and no one seems to do these days. But the talk therapy component is the critical piece that is missing. It's complicated. It's not as simple as just treating a mood disorder. It's you know, the biology of mood disorder is one thing, but the context of that mood disorder, whether it's character functioning or trauma or you said you live in a stressful lifetime, all that stuff contributes. Yes, for sure, losing some weight, exercising more, listening to music absolutely measures up well against medication in terms of reducing the risk of depression. So you're doing all the right stuff there, but you also have to do the talk therapy. It's unrealistic to think that it's just going to get better because you're listening to classical music.
Okay, and that's – all right. And my husband and I were seeing a therapist together and separately.
That's
different.
Right. So, that's great. So separately and together, that's all ideal. But the alone part, the Christine therapist, is the one that's going to be very important to reduce the risk of depression, really. The other thing is – oh, crap. The other question is what's your diagnosis? I mean, if you have dysthymia or you have bipolar disorder, those are highly biological problems that not likely you're going to stay off medication. That's just
what was the first one?
Dysthymia.
I don't know that, but okay.
Dysthymia is like somebody who's just always depressed, and it's just it's a specific diagnosis. It's a hard one to make, frankly, and I'd be you know. I want to be sure you make the right diagnosis on that. But you don't sound depressed right now, so I would sort of put dysthymia. Dysthymia means you're really kind of always depressed.
Honestly, I think right now for me it's a little bit situational. And I've been in the past diagnosed chronic depression, and in my 20s I was actually hospitalized for it.
Yeah.
But, yeah, I've been doing okay. I mean, I kind of am I'm a lot like my grandmother. I think she would put on a face, you know, when somebody comes in, you can really put it up and you look fine.
Yeah.
And then you're alone and it's bad.
Did you have trauma growing up?
Did I?
Yeah.
Or do I?
Did you? Growing up.
What was that? A little. I mean, it's not extreme, nothing extreme. A little bit of alcoholism in my family and maybe some mild abuse, but nothing to like it. I mean, I know a lot of people with a lot of worse stories being in foster care. And, you know, we adopted a little girl
because you're accustomed to hearing the most profound traumas doesn't mean you didn't have trauma.
Okay.
That's like saying, hey, I was in a car accident the other day. I broke my femur. I got some internal bleeding and I got a concussion. But, man, a lot of people die in car accidents. What am I worrying about? It's like, yeah, you got some stuff we got to handle too.
Sorry. That's a good point. It's true. I mean, nobody was murdered in front of me. But, there was some. I mean, and I've had a lot of therapy, but I was out of it for quite a long time. And we just, actually about a month before he lost his job, we were joined it in again because we were arguing. And
good.
I said, we need to get into therapy, so...
All right, here's the most important thing, Christine. Let's just sort of wrap it up with this. You sound very enlightened. You sound like you're really taking good care of yourself. You're willing to do the right works and stuff. The key is follow-up. Make sure somebody's monitoring you because you can't monitor yourself. You can't be objective about your own condition. Just make sure somebody's monitoring you and that if you do need something more, that you're at least somebody's watching you. That's all. I think it's great that you're off medication. That's always the goal. Medicines are bad. That's where we start from. Now, if the depression is worse and that the medicine risk of the medicine is worth it, well, okay. So you and a physician make that decision. Okay?
Okay. Yeah, that is totally fair. Now, can I ask you a neglect question?
Yep.
Thank you. Okay, so we adopted my older daughter. She's 10 now, going on 11, when she was 4. And her little sister we actually got her little sister first. And they actually have 6 brothers, but they're all adopted by different families. And I'm curious about this neglect, like what do you know about it? Because I've heard so many different things. And honestly, the biggest problem she has, and she has an amazing therapist that we got 2 weeks after she moved in with us, and he's been with us ever since. She gets into these really I hate myself moods. Like I think she's super smart.
How old is she?
She's 10 going on 11.
Yeah,
we kept her in.
I mean, yes, that's neglect. I mean, that's that problem. And neglect is considered actually the most severe form of abuse.
I agree.
Yeah. And so, there's a deep core of shame and feeling flawed. And unless you can kind of get at them, or usually you need professional help to get assistance with that. Yeah, this can go in a bad direction. And if the neglect is profound at certain developmental windows, they lose the capacity to understand feelings or empathize with other people at all. Those kids can have severe deficits.
Right, which is why we pay for private school.
Good, it's all good. It's all good.
We do everything we can for her.
It's good.
And she's come a huge amount of, and I don't think enough people know about how bad neglect is. I mean, you always think, oh, sexual abuse, physical abuse is the worst thing. But honestly, the worst thing you can do to your kids is ignore them, I think.
Christine, you're absolutely right. And not just ignore, but really be disconnected emotionally. And that kind of empty space is a bad place. And there's a lot of, just look at the literature on Romanian orphans to understand how bad it can get. Thanks, Christine. I got to move on. Good luck with all that. I got to go out to Callie. Is that your name?
Yep.
Yes, that's my name.
What's going on?
I'll tell you. I wanted to know, my main question is, can somebody's biology make it so that marijuana causes mental health problems?
Well, it's not their biology. It's well documented. It's not very common, but cannabis is well known to cause several different mental health issues. Panic attacks can get precipitated. And again, the theory is that that person already was prone to panic.
Well,
certain anxiety disorders, even psychotic episodes can happen. Seizures, there's all kinds of, it's a drug. So drugs affect your brain.
Okay, all works, right. So. Well, the reason I asked you that is because, as a matter of fact, I did have a panic attack a while ago. And I used to be not a heavy smoker, but a daily smoker for sure. Mm-hmm. I'm in college, so it was finals a couple weeks ago, and I had this, I'm not sure how you would classify this episode, but I just went ahead and thought, you know, it has a lot of features of a panic attack, but not only was it finals, but I have kind of a strange family situation, and like both my parents will call me to complain about it,
mm-hmm.
and it sort of, I had another sort of incidence of this like last October, so I was wondering, is it more related to an external problem, or is it this, you know?
It all kind of goes together, right? How long would you stop smoking pot?
How long? About 3 weeks.
Yeah, well, it's the withdrawal. Withdrawal from pot can go on for 6 weeks. So it's, you're in the withdrawal window, and you're going to be not sleeping right. You're going to feel irritable, and you're going to be a little bit kind of edgy. All that is.
Well, it's funny you say that. I actually don't feel edgy at all. Like, it wasn't like, as soon as I made the decision, like, okay, no more. You know, there's other health problems. It was just like gone.
No, but I don't mean you're edgy like you're craving the drug. I mean it affects sleep. It affects thinking. It causes panic and anxiety very commonly those few weeks after you stop. So you're in the withdrawal period.
I guess I should give you a little bit more information, too. When I had these, it wasn't when I was withdrawing from it. It was, like, briefly before. And then that kind of triggered my decision. Like, I better stop everything I'm doing.
Okay, all right. So it's it can go either way. It can be when you're using or when you're coming off.
Okay.
But it sounds like you've got a lot of stuff you want to deal with. And so why not get some therapy, right? I mean, you got the family stuff. I mean, it's all going together. It's all,
Certainly is.
Not everyone gets panicked, so you got to have some genetic element for that. The cannabis is contributing to some degree one way or another. And then the circumstance are, big deal here. So therapy, all right? College is a great time to start therapy. There's age.
I agree.
There's age-specific services that are designed specifically for you and your age group, and it's free. It's never a better time. What school are you at?
What school? I'm at VCU in Richmond, Virginia.
DCU?
VCU, Virginia Commonwealth University.
Oh, fantastic. Well, take advantage of the health services there, okay?
Yes, I will. Thank you so much.
All right. Thank you for your calls. I want to thank also Dr. Stephen Porges, who joined me earlier. StephenPorges.com is the website. It's, again, his book is The Polyvagal Theory. Here's a mouthful. Neurophysiological Foundations of Emotion, Attachment, Communication, Self-Regulation. And it is worth the read if you're interested. You got to be kind of interested in this field. It's pretty dense stuff. He's coming up in a new book we're looking for called Clinical Applications of the Polyvagal Theory. Remember to support the show and our products here. So Mr. Corolla continues to look me in the eye once in a while. See you guys soon.
This is Corolla Digital.